Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The Athletic.
The Phil Hayes Show.
Hello there, welcome to the show. The Phil Hayes Show is brought to you by The Athletic and The Square Ball. You can get in touch with the show via the new Twitter account, which is at The Phil Hayes Show. I'm Dan Moylan, hello. Today, joined by my colleague from The Square Ball, Michael Normanson.
Hello.
And if you missed the announcement, Phil Hayes had an operation on April the 29th to remove a benign brain tumour. Pleased to say Phil was in touch just before the Brighton game over the weekend to say that the operation went to plan and he's now spending time recovering. Before Phil was off, we recorded a top 10 signings feature that's going to run every week for 10 weeks, so you'll still hear Phil's dulcet tones on the show. We'll play that out in a bit, but while Phil is absent, we'll have guests in from the world of Leeds United. Next week, we're going to have on the Leeds United Chief Executive Officer, Angus Kinnear, but this week, absolutely delighted to welcome today's guest, former Leeds United left-back, title winner, and current LUTV co-commentator, Tony DiRigo.
Hello!
Amazing to have you on. Thank you so much.
You're more than welcome.
Right now, you can subscribe to The Athletic for a special price of $3.99 a month for 6 months, 40% off the full price of a sub. You'll enjoy great analysis and in-depth features from the very best football writers around, as well as ad-free versions of all these podcasts. Amitai's on the line from Athletic HQ. What's on this week, Amitai?
Well, this week, in the place of Phil Hay, they sent me down to Brighton, where I ended up writing a piece about Gianni Alioski and his future and all that sort of stuff, while kind of trying to avoid mentioning the club that he could potentially join. It was quite interesting. I don't know, it's one of those where I think all of my frustrations with him over the course of the season came out. But aside from that, there's also been a really good interview with Alfonso Pedraza up today by Adam Crafton, which I've been reading before I started doing this, which is really interesting. I don't know if you guys remember him, but he was obviously the left-back or left-winger at the time who came in under Gary Monk for the second half of the season. Played quite a few games, scored at Birmingham. In particular, I quite like the fact that he refers to Dallas and Calvin. So clearly ended up being quite good friends with Calvin Phillips while he was at Leeds, and said that, you know, despite only being there for 6 months, felt the love of the fans. He's now involved in Villarreal's Europa League game, which I suppose by the time this goes out, they'll either have gone through or been knocked out by Arsenal. But yeah, really interesting read. And we also have a piece from Ollie Kay, which is on the Champions League. And I think he's spoken to David O'Leary for that. So that should be really good.
Yeah, and we're going to hear from Oliver a little bit later on in the show. Thanks for the update, Amitai.
Cheers. Thanks, guys.
Cheers, Amitai. Right, head to theathletic.com/LeedsPod to take advantage of the 40% discount. That's theathletic.com/LeedsPod. And if you're enjoying the podcast, why not leave us a review? Into the football and the final throws of the season now, Tony. Not a great one down at the Amex at the weekend. Can you talk us through it from your point of view?
It was one that I always was worried about, even before the game. I talked to Bryn, actually, and, you know, Brighton away on paper looks one that we should be winning. But after what happened previously in April, those fixtures and how we got through them and how well we played, I always thought at some point, we're going to come down from that sort of level. And that game was the perfect one to do that, of course, with Phillips out, Rafinha missing as well. Unfortunately, we just never were quite at it. And of course, Brighton, desperate for 3 points to keep their Premier League survival going, and they certainly deserved it.
From a professional's point of view, why does that drop-off happen? Why did you anticipate that happening?
Simply because when you play the likes of Liverpool, Manchester United, Manchester City, you don't need any sort of motivation. In fact, you're going out there thinking, wow, you know, we're going to have to be very, very good today, make no mistakes whatsoever, just to get something out of the game. And the boys did that, and they put everything into it. You suddenly get through that period, and now you've got a game, I think, that you're expected to win, and it's a different mindset. It shouldn't be. You should go out there and try and do the same thing, but it's a different mindset. And that's where normally crowds would help you and get you through those sort of moments. But when I was down there at the Amex, you know, there was no one there. We started slowly. They played well. They scored their first goal. And did we really look like we were ever going to get back into the game? I didn't think so. And I just thought, right, we're a couple of percent off. And as soon as you're a couple of percent off in the Premier, you're going to come unstuck. And that's what happened.
How much of that percentage is Calvin Phillips?
It's a big chunk. I have to say, I thought Cock did okay in that position. But quite clearly, when you're missing two of your best players, which is Phillips and Rafinha, you're going to be off, aren't you? You're going to be slightly down. And that, I suppose, a bit of invention is where Rafinha missing was a problem. But Calvin just steadies the ship. He really does. And Cock, I thought, played that position well. But what he didn't quite give us was the passing range that Calvin has. And that half turn, he gets the ball, turns, and just plays very quickly. Robin Cock, of course, he's coming back from fitness. He's trying to make sure he makes no mistakes. Again, I thought he did well, but he just wasn't Calvin Phillips.
Is it a cumulative thing then? Because you talk about being a couple of percentage on the maximum. So you've got Calvin out. You've then, you know, you're losing Rafinha. Rodrigo's not fully at it. Do all those things then contribute to the subpar performance?
Yes. And then, of course, you're looking at other players then to right, you know, step up and try and beat their man or you know, show what they can do. And I just never quite felt that, unfortunately. And then, of course, you have to look at the opposition and what they're doing. I thought Brighton played well. We saw in the first game at Elland Road how they play. I think they're a neat, tidy, technical side. I think Graham Potter's done a decent job there. I know it's easy to say, but I don't think they quite deserve to be in the position they are in the league. I think they're slightly better than that. However, I don't think they're as good as us, and I think we should beat them all day long. Yet, they've taken 6 points off of us.
So you do think they're better than the league table suggests. What is it that they've got wrong then, and why did we come unstuck against that?
I think what they don't do very well is score goals. They just can't score. If you look at their goals against, they're the best in the bottom half of the table. So they don't concede many goals at all. But you've got to score some as well. So it's getting that balance right. I'm not sure they've quite got that. Mope has scored one or two, but just not enough. I look at Trossard. I think he's a really good player. Bissouma's excellent. The big back three they've got, of course. Ben White, yeah, I thought he played extremely well. Unfortunately, forget that. However, I just think they're a decent outfit, and they'll be absolutely fine.
Do you think that there are certain teams that set up in a certain way, play a certain style against Leeds, that for whatever reason we just come unstuck against, like we've seen twice with Brighton this season? It just seems to happen with some clubs.
I look at the styles or the tactics that other sides use, and I certainly think when teams try and play two up top, I think then we look slightly different in that, of course, we will then play three at the back, whether Calvin Phillips or Robin Cock, dropping in and dropping out again. So we do that. We do it well, but I just think that causes us a little bit of more of a problem. And also when teams have three centre-halves, they sit back and just pick us off from midfield when we don't pass well. And that happened, of course, a lot more in the early part of the season. Not so much now, but those sort of teams that are very quick on the break certainly causes one or two problems.
What do you make of Bamford at the moment? Because he, against the three centre-backs, he did look very isolated. Do you think he's out of form, or is he just crowded out there?
Out of form is difficult because, unfortunately, strikers are all about goals. Simple as that. And he's not scoring many recently. However, you have to look at the sort of service he's getting and what sort of support he's getting. And I don't think he's had too much. Obviously, Click used to be that player to run forward and help out. He's obviously out the side and not really playing to the top of his form. As we mentioned, I think earlier when Rodrigo was playing earlier, he looked very good and helped and linked. He's been injured as well. So you put all that together. Tyler Roberts is the one, and I think he's slowly getting there, but he needs a goal. He desperately just needs a goal, and I'm sure his confidence will blossom.
With the two up front for the opposition, do you think we're too reactive in a way? I mean, I'm loath to criticise Marcelo Bielsa because he's Marcelo Bielsa, and I clearly know nothing in comparison to the great man. But by changing our style and our, particularly that deep line midfield role, it just alters the whole scope of the game, doesn't it, really, that by having that midfielder drop deeper?
Well, when you say reactive, we exactly are reactive, but it's all worked out beforehand. So we know exactly, however a team lines up against us, we know where to go and how to play it. And you're talking about reactive. I mean, yes, we are changing positions slightly. It's only a little bit here and a little bit there, but Marcelo has got his plans. He works them all out beforehand. Every single player knows what he's doing. And when they see two up top, or when they see one, or one drops off, or three up top, the boys know exactly what to do. So I just think we probably favour when they have one up top and two out wide. I think we're better against teams like that.
Does Alioski know what he's doing? He sometimes hides it well.
Here we go.
You're a left back.
Yes, I know.
I mean, the best one I can remember from my lifetime.
Stop it.
It's true.
I tell you what, I think Alioski, you've got to remember what he has done for us, you know, in the championship, I got to say, because let's get this out there straight away. He's not a left back. Okay. He cannot defend at that level to what's required. Now we're talking about, we're in the Premier League now, you know, we're looking to get into those European spots. We're looking to go higher and higher. And but Gianni's done a fantastic job. You know, he really has. And I love, I think his attitude, his the way he applies himself, but he's just not a left back. And you can see that, you know, in certain instances, certain positional sense, certain challenges, but he's doing a fantastic job. Whereas I think then you look at someone like Stuart Dallas, who actually can play left back, who can play midfield, who can play right wing, left wing, or wherever. Yeah, it's difficult, but I think he's been very, very good. But I think when you're now stepping up in grades and you're looking at the next level and the next level, you know, we all have our ideas of what positions I think we need some strengthening in. And of course, left back will be one of those.
So what does it take to be a left back at the next level?
I think now you look at every left back. That's an interesting question, because when I first started, and this obviously a long time ago in football, I thought 50, 60% of the games that I played in were very easy, in that I knew my opposite number. I could easily physically run past him for fun, et cetera, et cetera. Now, there is no one like that. Now they're all athletes, and I would especially put fullbacks as that. So not only have you to get up and down the pitch, you have to defend extremely well. You know, you have to give something going forward. And you've got to be a bit of everything. And certainly an athlete is one of those. Now, I think you look at Luke Ayling, you know, the way he bombs up and down that right-hand side is just tremendous. You know, he's got the height to defend as well. And then I look at some fullbacks that played against us, and I thought against Manchester United, look at Wan-Bissaka and Shaw. You know, both of those players, I mean, they are fit boys. Actually, Shaw surprised me because he's quite chunky, but I tell you what, he is quick and he's got great feet and he gets up and down. So they were giving us problems, but they're fullbacks. But that's the modern fullback. And I think that's what I used to do. You know, I remember playing some games and I'd have two, the winger would be left out the side and I'd have two fullbacks against me because they're worried about me. I think that's weird, but that's what sometimes used to happen. Now, everyone has to be, you know, good enough, fit enough, strong enough, quick enough, and good defending to do it yourself. And that's what a lot of the top teams, I think, have got. And that's what we need to aspire to.
The thing with Alioski that always gets me is the decision making, and I think that's probably how you elevate yourself to the next level. I'm guessing that that's partly involved in it. But I want to know: can you teach that in with a player, or is that an inherent quality?
You can teach it to a certain point, but then you have a ceiling. I think you're quite right. When you've got certain players, it's like young players that, you know, they make mistakes, but they then learn, and it is all about positioning. So if you're a goalkeeper, it's about positioning. You know, same with centre half. You might have a yard or two less speed than your striker, but you can deal with them because you can read the game well and you don't make those rash decisions. And I think that's where, as you go up and up and up, that's what the better players do. They make better and better decisions. And then, of course, the opposition that you're playing against, you make a mistake, they're going to punish you a lot more than, of course, we're used to in the championship.
When did you settle on being a left back? Because I'm guessing growing up in Australia, you were probably the best player by a fair distance, and your best player isn't a left back, generally speaking.
No, I was a left winger. And then I came over to Aston Villa, started at, you know, left wing, left midfield. And then we went on tour to Germany, an under 18 tour of playing against, I think it was Schalke I played against. And the left back got injured in the first 5 minutes. And they said, right, you can you get back there and just fill in. And of course, I still bombed up the left, but I could actually, defend as well. So I stayed there. They said, right, you know, you're staying there. And of course, then you learn about the positional part of the game, tactics, etc. But I think I fortunately had that ability to go forward, and I've kept that. Yeah.
What would it be like playing alongside a player like Llorente? We're learning more about him week by week. I'm keen to get your thoughts on him because there's a certain enigmatic quality about him, I think, in that he's a bit funny, he's a bit mad, but he seems to be really skillful as well.
A bit fun, a bit mad. Yeah. He's a bit good. I think that's the good way of putting it. I think when we first saw him, can you imagine? He's a Spanish international. Okay, he's come over to Leeds United. He's so frustrated that he can't stay fit and play. And of course, then when we saw him straight away, we are yearning, screaming out for centre halves, of course, that can get it down and play and start the attacks off, because that's how we play. Even Melier starts them off, for goodness sake. And he was trying to do that, but maybe trying a little bit too much. But I also like the way that he defends. He always tries to get a bit physical. Now that you're allowed to get physical to a point, of course, these days, which I must admit is the way the laws are going. But I like the way that he always tries to, get in there and nick the ball off the centre forward. But when he does that, it's then the next touch and the next pass I really like, because it's always forward. It's always looking, can I find that angle, that diagonal? It's not right. I've got it now. Back we go and we keep it. So I think he's really good at starting us off or nicking it back. And then, of course, when the opposition are trying to commit bodies forward, we find that space. And the quicker it gets forward through Llorente or whoever it is, the better.
So Llorente and Cock versus Ben White, do you think we got the best outcome by getting those two instead of spending the same amount of money on Ben White?
I think Ben White is a wonderfully talented individual, absolutely. And I think it would have been easy for him to stay and slot in. There wouldn't have been this transitional problem. However, when you're talking about where to spend your money, you've got to say, we've got the better end of the deal, because what they're talking about for Ben White was whatever it was, 25, 30, 35 million. We've got a couple of players for it. So, I think all ways round, we've done well for Ben White, but also I think we've got two very good players.
Returning to Brighton then, there was a distinctly end-of-season feel about it from Leeds United's performance, that slightly off-the-peak output that we saw. Do you think if we maybe had 10 points fewer on the board, or we were around 16th, 17th, we'd have seen a different performance?
Absolutely. Yep, I do. And as a player, I don't like to say that, because when you go out on the pitch, you're never trying to change your level of performance. You always want to give, absolutely 110%. But sometimes it's just nature. It's natural. We've had some, really, really big games, and the boys have done incredibly well. But then you go to that sort of game, and they're the ones I always think these are even more important to get absolutely right, and we didn't.
Just looking at some of the other stuff that's happened in the wider football world, we've seen a bit of an uprising at Manchester United.
Mm.
Have they got a right to be unhappy?
I think certainly they have a right to be unhappy. It's how you show it, I think, is that's what you can then we can talk about. That's probably not the way to do it. But I think it's vital that we remember, certainly as players, I'm clear as day of what's the important part of football, and it is the people that come and support you. And I think that has to be, kept that way for as long as possible. I think we've already, we've sold out our league 20 odd years ago, and then the finances have just suddenly changed the way the game has gone. And now, we have got certain owners or American owners in the respect of just trying to, make as much money out of the game as we can. And I think, fortunately, there is a bit of an uprising amongst a lot of people that's trying to stop that. And I think that's the right thing to do.
When it comes to the other side of the fence, things that we're a little bit happier about, getting back in the stadium is an obvious point. It's a rhetorical question, but hopefully the Spurs game will be the last game that you're co-commentating on where we don't have fans. What sort of a difference is it going to make to the experience? Because you're one of the people who's been inside the grounds and we've kind of been outside looking in. Mm. So what has that been like?
Awful. It really hit me, just the first game it hit me, because it was at Anfield and I remember playing there I know what the atmosphere can be like. It's our first game back after 16 long years away. So, of course, everyone is, proud as punch and can't wait for the game. And then the first 10, 15 minutes of the game is just amazing. What a start it was to the game. I thought, wow, we are, we're back and this is just tremendous. And then I thought, there is no one here. And then I'm looking at Bryn and he's looking at me and, we're shouting away, but we are up in the gods right at the back of the stadium. We've got like binoculars trying to see the boys. We can't hear anything. I'm thinking, wow, is this what it's going to be like? And that's what it has been like. And the worst thing is I'm starting to slightly get used to it, which is I don't want to. It is awful. And in certain moments in games as well where things are just amazing, I would love to hear that crowd and we just haven't heard that. So, yeah, it hasn't been good at all. It is what it is. We've made the best of a bad job, but I just cannot wait for fans to get back in.
We spoke to Bryn recently on the Square Ball podcast and he was saying similar things to what you've just said there, that the difference in experience and how normally as a commentator or co-commentator, you're going to feed off the crowd, but you must find yourself changing what you do, I guess, to a certain extent.
Well, I just listen to Victor Orta, to be honest, and that's all I have to do. I just take, even with headphones, I can still hear Victor.
Is he?
Oh, he's loud. Oh, that boy's loud, let me tell you. Listen, there's a bit of noise there, but it's, you're talking from director's box and stuff, so it's not what we are used to. So, it has been difficult. Saying that, some of the football that we've been commentating on and watching has been pretty special. So, me and Bryn, we look at ourselves sometimes and thinking, wow, did they just do that? Did they do that? And just the spirit they show. So, no, it's been enjoyable, but we can't wait to, as I say, to get a full house back.
Although Phil's not with us on the podcast at the moment, we recorded these a little while ago. To keep you here on the show, Phil, we are speaking from the past right now.
You should have pretended that this was live from the LGI. Anything's possible. Anything's possible with technology. But yes, so we're going to go through my top 10 signings at Leeds United since I started covering the club. Just as a bit of a disclaimer before anybody gets upset, I tried to look at this in terms of the cost of the player, obviously, this kind of value for money, but also the impact that they actually made. So to give you two quick examples, neither Chris Wood nor Ross McCormack feature in this list, even though they scored a lot of goals in individual seasons and they made Leeds a lot of money when they were sold. The goals didn't really amount to anything in a kind of positive sense. And I was sad and a bit guilty about leaving out Patrick Bamford, who has been excellent. But again, I felt that £7 million that he was signed for was probably market price at the time, and it took him a little bit of time to get going, and basically not everybody could quite squeeze in, but he was very, very close. But yes, these are my 10 top signings over the past sort of 15, 16 years.
So we'll count these down 1 week at a time. Let's start now then with number 10. Who's your number 10?
Number 10 is Patrick Cusnobo, centre-back from the Simon Grayson era, and a signing in 2009 that was, I still think, very, very influential in Leeds going up in that season, and going up in a season where they absolutely had to go up. There was a previous podcast where we were talking about the latest accounts at Leeds and the fact that had it not happened second time round under Bielsa, you would probably have been looking at some fairly major cutbacks and some changes to the financial structure. I think it would have been very difficult for Leeds in the structure they were in at the time with Bates as chairman to have had the same budget, the same wage bill, the same squad as they did in that final season with Grayson. But if you remember before Grayson came in, one of the big problems for Gary McAllister was the fact that Leeds were a side who conceded goals and conceded goals consistently and didn't ever seem to be able to tie themselves up at the back. And Grayson made quite a big impact there initially. He got Richard Naylor in, he had Sam Sodgi towards the end of his first spell, or his first season, and there was that long run of wins at Elland Road. There was the run to the playoffs and obviously defeat in the end, but a kind of staging post for what came the following season. And I remember when he signed Cusnobo, he said, you know, I genuinely think this is a bit of a coup. Cusnobo had left Leicester, he was a free agent and available on a free transfer. I think there was championship interest in Cusnobo, but Leeds appealed to him and the setup appealed to him. The idea of trying to win promotion appealed as well. And I always felt that tying him in with Naylor and forming that pairing at the back was absolutely critical in giving that team the base it needed for others further up the field to thrive and to be as effective as they could be. So you still had Beckford in there and you had Housen and you had Snodgrass and you had Becchio, but you weren't suffering in the way that they did at times under McAllister from the fact that they were scoring goals, but goals were going in at the other end. And even though you could get Beckford up to the point where he was scoring 34 times in a season, you still weren't getting out of League One. And to my mind, on a free, and given the impact he made, Cusnobo, he was the Evening Post Player of the Year that season. I think that goes down as a really terrific signing.
Signed in the summer of 2009, no fee involved. He made 49 appearances for Leeds United, scored one goal. Probably best remembered in terms of an iconic image, and it's funny how these images become iconic. The head injury on his debut and the bandage became something that was synonymous with him.
Yeah, because he cut his head very early in that, and there were players at Leeds who got the distinct impression that as he went further down the lane in the season, he was wearing it because it became habitual and it was a bit of a Cusnobo trademark, as opposed to actually needing that bandage. He certainly needed it to begin with. But the two things that jump out to me, it's the bloodstained Terry Butcher-style picture post the win at Old Trafford, but also the image of him on crutches towards the end of the season after doing his Achilles against Millwall. And, I mean, the consequences for him of that injury were huge. It ruled him out of the World Cup, which he would almost certainly have gone to with Australia. And I think we can safely say that he was never the same player again afterwards. When he came back, his pace had gone, his body was starting to fail him slightly. And it was a very, very cruel blow. And I remember Grayson saying when he came up to the press conference after that Millwall game saying, you know, he's in tears in the tunnel, and I've given him a big hug because I know what this is going to mean, and I know what the cost of it is going to be to him. But as I say, at the Evening Post, we gave him Player of the Year that season. I think he was massively influential.
Well, that's your number 10 in the top 10 signings since you started covering Leeds in 2006, Phil. We will move on to number 9 next week.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to michelobultra.com/courtside to learn more.
Well, it's coming round for the 30th anniversary of you signing for Leeds, Tony.
I bet that's gone
past in the blink.
30?
30.
No
years.
Way.
Yeah. Well, we've been doing a series of podcasts over on the Square Ball, the Match Ball 30. We've been doing like a Match Ball, like an after-game podcast for every game from promotion in 1990 through to lifting the title in 1992. And we've just got to the end of the first season, the post-promotion season. So you're about to sign for us, spoiler alert.
Yes, I did. Yeah, that was a good decision, I have to say. One of my best decisions I've made, to be honest. Yeah, coming from Chelsea there.
Leeds fans will be shocked to learn of a contract dispute with Ken Bates before you were sold.
No, they won't. Don't give me that. Good old Batesy. Who doesn't love Batesy? Yeah, I found it difficult at Chelsea because he certainly had his fingers in every single pie. And I mean that on the football side, which is just not right. I don't, you know, that doesn't work. And we had some really good players down there at Chelsea, yet we got relegated first season. We then got promoted by an absolute mile second season. Things went okay from there. I was in the England squad, et cetera, et cetera. But I just felt we were, you know, moments away from catastrophe, and we could win 5 or 6 on the trot and then lose 5 or 6. And that really was just the outside influence of the good old chairman. And it was difficult because I started at Aston Villa, and Aston Villa at the time won the European Cup. They were the, you know, title holders as well. And it was the breakup of that side when I got in, meaning the club is all about winning things. And I go to Chelsea, I'm thinking, is this about winning things? So why is there so many problems in the background that we can't all row in the same direction? And I found that hard. A really good bunch of lads and players, you know, Scottish internationals, Welsh, England, the whole lot. But, you know, we certainly didn't achieve what we kind of should have done. Hence why I was never going to, you know, sign there another contract. And that was the issue. He was trying to get me to sign a new contract from 2 years out. And I refused, you know, all the way through.
It's interesting that the notion that a club has to all be rowing in the same direction, as you put it, because we've seen it as one of the catalysts for what Leeds United is doing right now. It's very rare, isn't it, that it happens the other way around, that a club can be successful when things are not united behind the scenes.
That's right. And when it's chaos off the pitch. And I will say, once I crossed that white line, I did put everything behind me and just concentrate on the game. But sometimes, you know, it's not enough. You need every little bit of advantage, you know, you can get. And certainly when things are happening off the pitch, it can be difficult. So Chelsea was like that, but I came to Leeds United and I found the exact opposite. I had, you know, Leslie Silva. I didn't even really know the guy's name, just that, you know, he has picked the right manager, the right people in charge to do their specific role. And everyone had the same intention of making, you know, the club great, whereas I didn't find that at Chelsea.
Is that what you walked in to find then? Because I'm interested to get a handle on where the club was at that point and how was it sold to you?
Howard Wilkinson had a chat with me and he said, right, we've now just finished fourth in the old Division One. So we've gradually added more and more quality. So we've added, obviously, the Gary McAllister, the John Lukic, it was Gordon Strachan, all these sorts of players. And now we know we still need 2 or 3 positions, and you are one of the key ones. We think with those 2 or 3 positions, we can really give it a go and improve from what we did last season. And then he went on to verbally talk and play 3 golf holes with me, right? Which I thought was slightly weird. But he found out that I quite like my golf. So he talked about how to play this par 4 and then a par 5. And I won't bore you all with it, but we did actually talk through each shot. And he was trying to, he said things like, okay, maybe you can hit the ball 300 yards, but actually what we need for this hole is to only hit it 220 into a certain position. And that's what you need to do. So he went on and on and on and on and on. And basically, if he just said to me at the start that we will use the tools we've got to our best advantage, no, I would have got it. Instead, he bored the tears off me for half an hour. I thought, all right, contract, give it to me, sign, stop this guy talking, you know. No, I tell you what, I just found him sincere. I found him full of passion, obviously knowledgeable, and I love what he was doing, you know, with the club and how he was building it. And he made me feel, you know, very important, as if I was an important cog that he needed. And that's what, as players, that's what you want.
What did he say to the team at the start of that season? Was there a moment where the challenge to win the division was laid down?
Never. No, that was never the case. It was always a challenge to be the best you can be in the next game. And we would prepare thoroughly. We would do everything we could for that next particular game. The aim was he brought it down to little chunks, really. And he was working out there, if we get average more than 2 points a game, you know, we're going to be there or thereabouts. But we just kept, you know, looking at it very short term like that and keep our standards extremely high.
Because that's counter to what Bill Fotherby put in his program notes the first game of the season. Do you know that he set that down? He said, we're going to have to go and win it this year.
You know, Bill, I mean, he can sell sand to Arabs, that boy. When I first actually came as well, myself, my wife, he took us in the back of his Mercedes and took us up and down, was it Old Woodley Lane or whatever, going up, you know, looking at the house. I said, Bill, is there anywhere else we can look at houses? He goes, no, just this one. What do you think? You know? It was really funny. But Bill was great because, again, he was a larger than life character, you know, had the club at heart. And again, that's the thing, because, you know, I didn't get my instruction from Bill Fotherby. I got my instruction from Howard Wilkinson, and that's the one we should be listening to. And that's the manager we certainly did.
Was that completely different then from where you'd been at Chelsea, where Bates was involved? And at Villa, will it have been Doug Ellis at that point as well?
Deadly Doug, yeah.
So you had a few.
Well, that was the best thing. I had Deadly Doug at Villa, and then, of course, Ken Bates at Chelsea. And then I actually ended up going to Chelsea with Deadly Doug rang me up when I was at Aston Villa as a 21-year-old and said, right, we're selling you to Chelsea. You've got an hour. I'm going to come pick you up. We're doing a swap with David Speedy of Chelsea, and we're meeting Ken Bates and David Speedy in the Posthouse Hotel, Heathrow. So I'm with Deadly Doug. Speedy is with Ken Bates. We're in the Posthouse Hotel. We're on the second floor. And it was like a hostage situation where you just walked across the path of each other. And he said to me, good luck. I didn't quite know what he meant, but now I did. You see, oh, he's got me there. We ended up going to the separate rooms and then not agreeing, actually. And then at the end of the season, they came in with a bigger money offer, and I had to go. So, it was nothing like that. At Leeds, I just found everything really strongly going in one direction, which was good.
Despite the wobble late on in that season, was there a point at which you knew within yourselves as a squad, perhaps, that you were going to win it?
No, I don't think there was any point we thought, right, you know, we're going to win this. I think we had confidence. We just kept, you know, looking at the next game. It was all about just winning that next game. Sometimes you get your head up and you think, oh, geez, we are close here, you know. But that then takes away your focus from what you should be, you know, really concentrating on. So it wasn't until, you know, we come on strong. Yes, we had our blip at Man City, but after that, we come on strong. And then certainly Manchester United succumbed to the pressure.
And how does it feel to be a title winner? So few people experience it.
Bloody good, mate. Let me tell you. Yeah, it's something that, you know, will live long in my memory. It was the best year of my career. But it's special because it's the people you do it with as well. And that feeling and that emotion, even now I have 50, 60-year-old guys coming up to me and give me a hug. And that's lovely because we shared those things together, you know, but the fans are certainly a huge part of it. So I think looking back, it was a year that, is the best in my career, absolutely.
What does it take to succeed at Leeds? Does the same still apply as it did then when you won the title?
Some things are very similar. I think you look at the players that the fans idolise or think very highly of, and a lot of the time it's the ones that just give everything that they've got. You know, it doesn't mean they might be the technically the best, but the ones that give everything for that white shirt, Leeds fans will take to you. I think they can maybe forgive the odd mistake here and there. What they can't forgive is a lack of application. So that's the first thing I would say. And then if you are having a bit of a bad time, you better not go in your shell. You get out there and go the other way and just go around and, you know, do even more. So I think that's where one or two players, you know, may find it difficult at a club like Leeds United.
I think that's partly where the root of the respect comes from the current team as well, because we know not only do they have to put it in on the match day, we know how hard they work through the week as well. And even if Alioski, for example, is having a bad game, you know it's not because he's not put the effort in. You know he's done more running than probably anyone else who's ever tried to play left back for this club.
You're absolutely right, because that's what they're expected to do, because I think the way that they play, the pace, the tenacity, the tempo is really impressive. And it's a team that's coming up from the Championship. You know, now you're playing against the big boys, yet still, you know, they're going. And I remember one instance, and there could be so many instances this season, but obviously we're away at Old Trafford. We're quite a few goals behind, yet we are still running like the Alamo trying to get back, you know, but they've got six. Doesn't matter. We're still going to come back at you. And I just love that. I think that is a brilliant attitude. So as fans, I think that, yeah, I'm glad you appreciate that because it's not an easy thing to do. Yeah, our boys have got that in spades.
So if Leeds is a club where you can't hide, that's what I took from what you said. Mm-hmm. Why is Leeds as a club like that? Is every club like that?
No, they're not. And it's interesting you say that because I just think of the clubs that I've been at. And you get some clubs that, for one, Derby County. I went to Derby and they were very, very pleased at finishing mid-table. My two seasons there, we finished, I think, eighth, seventh and eighth, which is the highest they've been for, well, since. They've never been that high ever again. But they were delighted with that. I wasn't delighted with that. Who wants to finish seventh or eighth? You know, I always go to a club thinking you want to win. Okay, you might finish seventh or eighth, but the aim surely is to be the best, you know, and Derby never kind of wanted to be the best. I just think Leeds, I think we want to be the best. And I think that's right. I think that's the attitude to have. Certainly Chelsea, the fans want to be the best, but the chairman had a weird way of going about it. So I think it is a mindset of the club as well. Yeah.
We've addressed that this season, saying how this year, everyone's delighted to be 9th, 10th, 11th. If we drop it down to 13th, everyone will still be fine with it. 2 years' time, if we're 10th.
No chance. We're going to go nuts, aren't we? We're going to go crazy. But again, I think that is right in that you have to try and improve. You have to want to be better. You have to want to finish higher. You have to look at the team and think, right, where can we make things better? How, yeah, these little margin, fine margin, that's what it's all about, you know. And Howard did exactly the same, brought in the right players to get out of the Championship and brought that next level up in the first year. The second year, he brought, I think, myself, Rod Wallace, Steve Hodge, you know, England international. So you need to keep going up and up and up and try and get that balance right while being supported by your boss and your chairman, and while all these other things are going on as well. You've got to get a lot of things right. And we, I think this season, have done fantastically well. Wherever we finish up, I said at the start, 12th or 13th, I think we can do slightly better than that. And I'm absolutely delighted. I think we've done tremendous. The style has surprised me that we've been able to do it playing that way. And that's the nice thing. But to play that way and go higher, we just need a little bit more quality. But I don't think everyone knows that. Everyone knows that's what happened at teams that are trying to go further up the table.
I've really enjoyed seeing us shake off like the shackles of history. Would you agree that Leeds has always been a club weighed down by its history? Because it's something that Howard Wilkinson had to do, was to kind of take the pitches down back in 1988 of the Reavy squad. And to a certain extent, you could argue with the successes that your generation had and then the flirtation with the Champions League, that it makes things harder when you go forward another 10, 20 years for these lot.
Yes, I can certainly see that. I look back now and I look at that 60-70 side and wow, so some of the numbers and the stats and the things they won and the amount of appearances, it's just incredible. They put us, you know, absolutely right on the world map, and it's a tough act to follow. You know, it really is, and it's been an absolute struggle. And only now and then we reach those heights again. But I think I came back, about a decade ago, started watching a bit more regular, seeing one or two games in League One and in the Championship, and it's been tough. You know, it's a tough watch when everyone thinks we should be back to those days, but reality, you got to just look at reality, and that wasn't the case. And you look at off the pitch, what a mess we were in, and it's taken a while to get us back to solid ground, building those foundations again. And interesting, Chelino was an interesting one because he came in, and okay, more than interesting to be fair, but let's just stick to interesting. He came in and actually sorted a few things out where maybe others, you know, wouldn't have done or couldn't have done because we're that much of a basket case. So when Andrea came in, he had a bit more tidying up to do, but he's done that and he's done fantastically well. So I think we've got a good foundation going forward now, and we can have lots to look forward to. But we know not too long ago how things certainly can turn.
I do wonder if Chelino not doing due diligence, that's the story that goes, that he didn't properly look at the books before.
Thankfully.
Thankfully. And actually, it was probably a blessing in disguise. Now we're a few years further down the line.
No, you're right. Yeah, because again, I hear certain things, but I know sometimes he is much maligned, but I know within the club, he actually took a few tough decisions that had to be made that weren't popular, but that certainly set us on the right path. Clearly, we had a long way to still to go, but he set us on the right path. So we'd hit rock bottom. We're now bouncing back up.
And it's fair to say probably that he got a hell of a lot of things wrong as well. And but you, both things can be true. He can fix some things, but can get some of the things disastrously wrong.
Oh, no, he got lots wrong as well. Let's be honest. I mean, yeah, let's not go through some of the managers. I mean, Radio 5 Live rang me and told me who they appointed as manager. And, you know, I can't even remember his name.
Dave Hockaday.
Sorry, that's the one. Sorry. I'm really sorry. I shouldn't have said that. But I couldn't. And when they said to me, I said, you're winding me up, you know. And but it was true. So I thought, wow, how far have we fallen, for goodness sake? And again, you know, and if Dave Hockaday came in and did a really good job, you think, wow, it's a masterstroke. But he didn't. And so therefore, it wasn't.
I remember being in a pub with a load of Leeds fans when that news was breaking, and we were basically all just on our phones looking up Dave Hockaday because no one had ever heard of him. And everyone was like, it can't be this guy, can it? There must be another one, surely.
You could argue that the journey has been, it's been worth it now because it feels like this is all part of one long, enjoyable payoff at the minute, because I'm certainly enjoying myself a great deal. How does it compare now when you watch the game to 30 years ago?
I look at some of the rule changes, really. It's probably the biggest difference. Of course, everything gets a little bit quicker. Tactics, it's funny, they do full circles. Everyone, you know, thinks, wow, this is an amazing new formation, but actually it was probably done, you know, back in the 70s and then again in the 90s and what have you. But for me, the big difference, I suppose, is the VAR and the changes in the regulations and what have you. So I find some of the challenges now difficult because some, in my day, I'm thinking, wow, that's a good challenge because he gets the ball and you get a piece of the man and that's fine. Now you get the ball, you get a piece of the man, you get a red card. As unfortunately, Coops found out at Manchester City. So, that is a bit different. But players just have to get used to it. So you need to, you know, work within those rules. But at the moment, I must admit, I think I enjoy it very much. I think the money that's come into it has been good and bad. The product, though, out on the pitch, I think is a pretty good watch.
I'm just going back to your playing days. You know, you couldn't have a nibble at somebody now without VAR picking it up. And I always look back on you as a very clean and tidy player, but I presume there were days when you might have given somebody a little kick just to remind them that you were there.
Yeah, and you could do it because you wouldn't get caught. And again, I got to be careful because as a player, you want to take every single advantage, okay? You know, whatever, by whatever means you can. But now you can't do absolutely anything, you know, nothing at all because you have, you know, 12 cameras on you every single angle and you're going to get caught. I think back in my day, I remember my debut, my goodness, when was that? 1984, and Mickey Thomas was playing for Chelsea. And I never, ever forget, green-eyed, bloody 18-year-old left back. I'm marking him at the post and the corner kick, and everyone's waiting for them to take the corner. And Mickey goes and walks in front of me, and he just walks back towards me and just stamps on my toe. And so as I've gone down swearing, I'm looking down at my foot, he's then elbowed me right in my nose. So now I'm holding my nose. My foot's killing me. And I spent the next game kicking the crap out of him. I chased him around. I booted him, whatever. So that wouldn't happen now. You know, you're not allowed to do that sort of thing. He would have been off or whatever, you know. So it was fun. I don't know. I just think, especially I remember at Leeds because that 91-92 season, the tempo of games a lot of the time was set by a David Batty crunching challenge. And if they were up for the fight, the opposition, you know, the guy might get up. If they weren't, he stayed down there a long time. And then we knew, you know, we were off because we could physically, you know, match teams. We could play, we could win games in lots of different ways, you know. And I think we're slowly taking a bit of that, you know, out the game.
As you mentioned, Batty, just intrigued to get your take on where he would fit in or would he just not fit in a Bielsa team, given the way he trained and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, that's an interesting one because Bats as a... as a teammate, there's no one better. You know, if I wanted to go to war, I want him alongside me, you know, absolutely. When it got technical or boring or set piece situations, he was no good. He just wanted to get out of the way. He caused havoc. He booted balls here, there and everywhere. So, but I think I'm doing a bit of a disservice because I think top players will thrive in any sort of environment because they're smart enough to learn and work out how to do it. And Bats physically was a great specimen as well. And sometimes you don't realise that, you just look at certain things, but Bats could do everything. So I'm sure, you know, he would have applied himself and do it. Would he have enjoyed it? Probably not. But he would have done it.
That early crunching challenge from Batty, you say, as a pace setter for any given game. One of the things we found looking back on the games from 30 years ago is how often Wilkinson's Leeds United came out of the blocks and had a game won inside the first 20 minutes, physically going at them, setting the tempo. Yeah. Is that something you found, that teams would just crumble under the pressure in those first 20 minutes?
Yes, not that I was kind of used to that, but just we used to start very quickly. And then I soon worked out that the old Ellen Road crowd, get them on your side and get them with you. And wow, you know, that makes a difference as well. And then you look at the opposition and sometimes you're right. You know, we could be one or two up in that first 20 minutes and you could just sense they were taking a step backwards rather than, you know, going forwards. And you're thinking, wow, let's just keep pushing them back. And yeah, it certainly made a difference. Of course, we were unbeaten that season at home. All that makes a difference as well. Suddenly that invincibility, that feeling you get at home. And even when you're goal behind, you think, that's fine because we're going to come back and score two or three. And we did.
We heard from Amitai at the start of the podcast about Oliver Kaye's article on the Leeds United Champions League run. Oliver is on the line now with us. Oliver, how are you doing? You all right?
Yeah, very good. Thank you. You?
Yeah, good. Thanks for joining us. And so David O'Leary, a figure who's got mixed reviews really in the eyes of Leeds United fans. He took us to some dizzy heights, including the semi-final of the Champions League, which was very much, I would say, his zenith. But there were some nadirs as well based around the book and his ego. What do you take from this interview?
David O'Leary is somebody who I think is probably sort of divides opinion amongst journalists as well. And I think there are a few who didn't quite like his sort of folksy charm, but all got tired of it. But I always got on quite well with him as a when he was managing Leeds, and I thought he did a very good job at Leeds. We can talk about that. But I got in touch with him and said, look, it's 20 years since the semi-final. Would you like to look back on that season and on your time at Leeds, you know, as Leeds manager in general? And yeah, he jumped at the chance. And look, he's a charming guy. The way he talks about that team is and those times are with great fondness. I mean, there's regret over what happened next. But there's, you know, there's real pride in having taken Leeds to that, you know, that pinnacle, really, you know, that Champions League semi-final. And I know basically that, you know, everybody, Leeds fans in particular, ended up looking at that as the height they fell from over the years that followed. And that perhaps ended up being seen sort of, you know, that memory ended up tainted by what happened next, because the, you know, the club had overstretched and overspent, living the dream, etc., to use the Peter Ridsdale phrase. But he was saying, look, I was never aware of what the club was spending. You know, I never was involved in negotiating transfers or negotiating wages. The club asked me who would I want to, you know, as long Lucas Radebe's long-term replacement. And he sort of said, Rio Ferdinand, he would be the perfect man. He said, if he'd known they were going to spend £18 million, he would have told them not to, because he didn't think, you know, he thought that would have been too much money. But it was still one of the few deals from that time that ended up a very good deal for Leeds, because he was sold at a profit. But I think, you know, in terms of the way he managed the team, the way he improved that team, I think you have to look back on that and give him some credit, because that Champions League campaign was, you know, it was full of real highs.
Yeah, I think we can probably look back on it slightly more fondly now that things are getting good again at Elland Road. It sounds like a really good article. It's live on The Athletic now. What's the one big thing that you think Leeds fans will take away from reading this?
I think they'll probably smile as they relive the memories of, you know, Alan Smith's goal in Munich and the Bowyer goal against Milan and Don Matteo goal in the San Siro, which obviously the fans still sing about to this day. Winning away to Lazio, battering Anderlecht 4-1. O'Leary said that, you know, the best performance of all was the 3-0 against Deportivo at Elland Road, which really was a fantastic performance. But, you know, then it all builds up to Valencia, that moment so near yet so far, really. And would you swap those memories? Yeah, perhaps there were times on, you know, terraces at Yeovil and Rotherham and places like that where you think, yeah, I wish we hadn't gone that high to fall that far. But it was, I think looking back now from the great place that Marcelo Bielsa has taken Leeds to, I think you can look back at them more fondly. And there's also an interesting little revelation about an encounter that David O'Leary had with Marcelo Bielsa recently, which I think will make fans smile.
Oh, that's a hell of a tease. Great stuff. We look forward to reading it. Thanks, Ollie.
Pleasure.
Well, what a season it's been. We're round to match day 35 of 38 against Tottenham at the weekend. Penultimate home game of the season, as we mentioned before. Last one without fans. What are we looking forward to with this one, Tony? Is it going to be harder because we've heard from Marcelo Bielsa in the last 24 hours? Costa's out for the season. Calvin and Rafinha both doubt.
Obviously, missing those two, we are not going to be stronger. of that is pretty clear. But I think we're going to have a rebound from the Brighton game. You know, I think you look back at our season, every time we have been slightly disappointing, I think we've come back, you know, strongly. And whether we've won or whatever, but we've been spirited and we've come back and put a performance in. So I don't expect anything different. But of course, we are playing a very different Spurs side now because suddenly Mr. Mourinho has gone. The shackles are kind of off. They're relaxing a little bit and they're starting to, you know, win the odd game here and there.
What has happened to Spurs? And it's great talking to you as an ex-pro because I wonder just how much of an effect Mourinho had on that dressing room. And are they going to be feeling a bounce now because he's gone and they're happier? Or are they going to be at sea because they've got a younger manager in charge? It's hard to unpick it.
I think someone like Mourinho, am I a fan of his? Yes, I think I am. Certainly his early days, I thought he was absolutely, you know, superb at Chelsea. But he does seem to have a shelf life at a club. And once it gets to that, you know, that second year, chaos reigns. And, you know, you look through certainly at Real Madrid, then when he come back to Chelsea, there is always issues. So I just wonder, do the players then suddenly get tired of that style of management? That's, to me, what it certainly looks like. And now you've got, obviously, a young lad, Mason, just coming in and taking over. And it's just probably a slight release to the players. And they can, I suppose, be given a bit more license to go and do what they naturally, you know, want to do rather than play in that very, very structured way.
What is Mourinho's style of management? For those of us who are not lucky enough to have played the game, what is it that he does and how do you compare it to some of the managers you've worked under?
I think certainly Mourinho is extremely thorough in his tactics. You know, I don't think there's too many players that can go and off cuff and do what they want. You know, positionally, you've got to do exactly what he's after. I'm not sure he is an attacking type manager. So when you look at Marcelo Bielsa, you know, at the start of the season, you think, well, how are we going to defend? This is how we defend. We attack more. We just have the ball and we keep attacking. Whereas Mourinho would be the opposite. You know, he would certainly work out a ways to frustrate the opposition or put someone on a player just to stop the game. Whereas, you know, we certainly don't do that. Yeah, so tactically he has that. But I think also then it's about the management side. And whereas at the start of his career and every time he goes somewhere, I think he does that great. But he ends up just falling out with certain people. And that's why I just wonder that management clearly is not one for the long term. When he came back to Chelsea, he said, right, I'm here for the next God knows how many years. And of course, they down tools, didn't they, in the second year? And that was it. You know, Hazard suddenly couldn't raise a leg. So there's got to be something with him, the ego, and those big players that doesn't quite fit after a certain time.
He seems to enjoy picking on a left back as well. He had Luke Shaw at Man United. He had, yeah. He's doing it to Danny Rose at Spurs as well. I don't see what problem he has with these people. I mean, in your career, did you have, under George Graham, I'm thinking in particular, he was the one that kind of pushed you aside at Leeds. What? How did that exactly break down, that relationship? And
no, actually, it didn't really break down at all. George was great. It was just that I had one or two injuries, so I couldn't play. You know, getting 40-odd games out of a season out of me at that point was difficult. I kept pulling my hamstring. I had a slight imbalance in my pelvis, which I found out later when I went to Torino, which could have easily been sorted out. But because of that, they basically wanted to reduce my wage by a heck of a lot. And that was what it was. A new contract, but it was like half the money. And yet I was getting a lot more. Lots of other clubs were offering that. And I said to George, listen, I can't take half the amount. You know, I'm still 31. I'm still playing at that sort of level. And he goes, yeah, I understand that. I fully understand that. I'd love you to stay, but you know, you can't do that. And I said, okay, fine. And he says, you know, what happens now? He says, listen, you come here as often as you want, do whatever you want. I'll help you as much as I can, you know, until you're ready to go. You just let me know. So I thought, well, great. You know, thank you very much. It was good. So I was actually heading to Middlesbrough. That was where I was going. And I think it was around the Ravanelli time. Brian Robson was in charge. But that started to drag on. So I was still at Leeds doing training. But I thought, right, let's sign at Middlesbrough. What's going on? And then Graham Souness rang at Torino. Says, you fancy a bit of an Italian adventure? I said, yep, give me a piece of that.
The glamour of Middlesbrough, not enough?
Funnily enough, no. I think in Turin, the Piazza, the Prosecco, the Ravioli. I went for Italy instead.
You know, you say Mourinho like loses a dressing room. Have you been in a dressing room where the manager's lost to that dressing room? How does that happen?
Yeah, when you suddenly don't have confidence in him, simple as that. And it's not nice. It's not something that you suddenly all decide. It's just that you can see that the manager's scrubbing around for answers because he really doesn't know what he should be doing or how to approach things. So it is difficult. And again, once you lose that 1-2%, you know, you're on that slippery slope then. And suddenly, you know, you don't listen to a lot of what he's saying. Whereas Firstly, the manager comes in at the start, you think that every single word, if he keeps coming out with the same messages and you keep losing, you think, hold a sec, this thing's not right here and you're not the man to do it.
So in terms of what we'll find now with Ryan Mason, have you ever worked under a manager who's younger than you? Because some of the players that are there are going to be in that situation at 20, because 29 is so young.
It is, and I haven't, and that's a really strange one. I think because we're coming towards the end of the season, I think because they have got kind of strong characters, Harry Kane, obviously, you know, a leading one of those, I'm sure they'll get through it and they'll see it to the end. And we just got to be wary because suddenly I see Gareth Bale smiling a bit and scoring hat tricks. Something in hold of the sec. What's going on here? So they're a dangerous outfit now. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think we can't underestimate them, can we? Given what happened down there, and we saw their quality because we started okay-ish, didn't we? I think. I was going to call it White Hart Lane. It's not. It's the new Tottenham Stadium. I thought we started okay-ish down there, but as soon as they got their noses in front, we collapsed as promoted teams can do, can't they, really, when there's no plan B that you can kick into action because you see the quality of their forwards.
Yeah, you're exactly right. The quality that they had. I mean, Son, was electric. You know, Harry Kane, the positioning, the movement, the passing of those two. And yeah, they soaked up the pressure. They allowed us to step forward, get out of position. We give it away and then bang, 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 you know, and that quality certainly showed. So that was a bit of a lesson to us. However, I think we are a different side since those days. I think just look through the games at April and how we played. We certainly can do the other side of it as well to a very high standard. So hopefully we won't get caught out the same way.
Will the likes of Bale and Harry Kane have one eye on the Euros at this late stage of the season?
I don't
want to pick up that knock. I just want to see it through so I can play at the tournament.
I think in the back of their mind, yes, but that's always really dangerous. I think what you have to go out, and I certainly did, you go out there still with 110% because that's when you do get injured if you don't approach it that way. So no, there's still, you know, lots to play for. And I think a lot of their players are playing for their futures. And I think the same with our players as well. You know, some at Leeds United are thinking, right, you know, I better put in some really good performances because I want to be part of this squad going forward.
Who do you think that is then? What, Tyler Roberts maybe? Alioski?
Yeah, obviously, Alioski, the left-back position, is one up for grabs. But again, Gianni's come in and done some really good performances, whether it's a left midfield or left-back. And I see Marcelo Bielsa certainly would like him to stay. And I can understand why, because, you know, he's a good character to have around. But I think when you're looking at improving, you know, where that would be, you know, one position. And Tyler's an interesting one because he's a player that you can see has got ability. But now, rather than thinking that, you know, we're going to see it in the future, he needs to produce it now and on a regular occurrence. And I think he is getting better and better. But if we're talking about, you know, that number 10 role, and if we're talking about a team going for a top six or top seven position, that player has to be scoring 10 goals, you know, 10, 12 goals. And that's the last bit that Tyler needs to improve on.
When it comes to Saturday, then, how do we avoid a repeat of what happened down at Spurs?
First thing we cannot do is, you know, make any mistakes early. Don't allow the opposition to get a, you know, goal up cheaply. And again, I think we have, you know, slowly got better at that. But then suddenly when we are on top, we've got to realise that actually we're still in a very dangerous position because of how they play. On the counter, they are, you know, very quick and have a lot of quality. But I think at the back, you can certainly get at them. So we are a balanced display, but just like the ones, the big teams we played against, you know, it's going forward at the right time together, understanding that we're going to keep the back door shut and making no mistakes. And no doubt, you know, Melier will pull off a few good saves here and there as well. The young man's, you know, been doing great.
Do you think we've become more streetwise as this season's gone on?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I look early on and think some of the passes we were trying to play and the amount of bodies we were committing in areas where we really shouldn't be at that stage of the game. You know, there's nothing wrong with kind of turning their centre half into the corner every now and then just to get them thinking in a different way. If you know it's always going to be the same sort of style, always to feet, always, you know, on the diagonal, it's so easy to defend against. You know, if I know how you're going to play, you're going to keep doing the same thing, I'm going to work it out pretty quickly and I'm going to put a stop to it. But if you got me guessing, then I think then it becomes more difficult. So that's where I think we've mixed it up a little bit better in that regard.
Do you think the slightly more is pragmatic, the right word, the more pragmatic approach, is that what is responsible for Patrick Bamford's slight drop off?
That's a good point. Yeah, but I also think it's still to do with, you know, the likes of, I think, Click not quite, you know, firing. And of course, then you've got, you know, Tyler not quite scoring those goals as well. And Rafinha being out for three or four games, that doesn't help either. Put all that together, I think he still does a great job, Patrick, up there. But of course, you keep talking about, you know, his performances recently. It's the goals, not so much the, you know, the I suppose the bits that he does. So it is an all round team game. I think the other thing, we've got better at set pieces actually as well. That's the big improvement, because I don't exactly know why we were so poor at it, but we certainly have improved, have got a lot better. And streetwise, most definitely, we are getting a lot more streetwise.
Do you fancy Bamford for a goal then at the weekend?
I always fancy Bamford for a goal. I always fancy us to win, simply because we always have the ability to rise to that sort of level, and we can. We, you know, we've shown it already. So I really do hope we put in a performance. It's going to be a little bit more difficult, clearly, without a couple of players missing. But yeah, I think we're going to rebound from that average performance at Brighton.
Have you had a chance to get a handle on what Spurs are doing under Ryan Mason that perhaps they didn't do under Mourinho?
Smile. It could be something as simple as that. Happiness, enjoyment. Yeah, I know it sounds silly, but you know, when you've got so much pressure on you, when you've got a manager that you know, wants a bit of confrontation now and then, I'm sure he's up, but he would have been up and down. Things aren't going well. You lose when you shouldn't. So all that pressure kind of builds and builds. And just to have it taken off slightly, obviously there's still a lot of question marks on those players, but just a different message, and it'll be different training. Things will be different. And there's no doubt that one thing I'm sure that Mason would have done is to get his players smiling a bit. And it sounds a basic thing, but, you know, back enjoying their football.
My hope is that it's gone the other way and it's got kind of a supply teacher end of term vibe to it, and everyone's just kind of doing their own thing, messing around at the back of the classroom.
I like your way you're thinking. Yeah, let's hope. Let's go with that one. I like his better, yeah.
What was Howard Wilkinson like in that regard? Did he keep you smiling? Was the messaging, was it varied up?
Not so varied. I think we were really diligent in what he did and what we did. We would work on set pieces, defending third, middle third, attacking third. When we were attacking, when we were defending, we would take them. I would be all over the pitch on a Thursday, you know, for an hour walking around, all in these different positions. And we kept doing it, you know, repetitive training, but it got you in the right position. So whenever the pressure was on, it didn't matter because you did it so often. Not so dissimilar to what Marcelo Bielsa does in the movements. Now, clearly, they probably don't work on set pieces as much as we did, but they clearly work on pattern of play and getting the ball transitioning and out from the back, you know, a lot more than we did. So, you know, certainly similarities in that point of view. I think the other thing, we had some really strong characters, obviously Strack being, you know, the leader. And that was the level that you had to maintain. So there was always a level in training, you know, on the pitch, the way you were. And that then bred amongst the senior players, and it just trickled down to everyone. So suddenly you were playing at a really high level. Anyone that came into training, if you weren't at it straight away, you were found out. Mm. You know, absolutely. And then signings would come in and think, whoa, geez, this is a bit pacey. What's going on here? Because, well, that's how we do it here. You know, that's what you have to do.
I can see real parallels with today's squad.
Yeah,
actually.
Absolutely.
And that group of senior pros that centered around Liam Cooper, Dallas, yep, Ayling, etc., who probably set the tone for the club.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and because they know what it's all about. And Strack, you know, was brought in to do exactly that. You know, Gary Mack. And then the beauty with our side is we had these two youngsters in Speedo and Bats who were just brilliant. You know, they were a great balance for each other, great mate, but they're great fun. So they kept things bubbling, yet we knew it was business time. We all got down to business.
So what do we expect to find on Saturday then? How will this one pan out? What do we get from Spurs? What do we get from Leeds?
What do we get from Spurs? I'm a little concerned because clearly you've got Dele Alli now, you know, coming back in and getting games. You've got Bale, who clearly has got great ability, whether he's got that appetite like he had a few years back, but in one-off games he can do anything. And then you've got Harry Kane, who's trustfully trying to get 100% fit for the Euros. So they're going to be at it. Yeah, that there's, you know, I think there's no doubt. And so are we. And I think it's going to be an entertaining game. I really do. You know, they're not going to be sitting back too much. They'll try and hit us on the counter. We just have to try and get back to what we were like in April, and then we'll give them a good game.
Do we win it?
Do we win it? I think we can. I think we can. If you tell me that they beat us, would I be hugely surprised? Probably not either. Just like any game this season, I don't know what's going to happen. You keep, you know, trying to read it. And it's only against Brighton, weirdly. I had a feeling about that one. But any other game, I'm thinking, well, you know what? Anything is possible. And I think, isn't that, as for fans, pretty cool? In that we could win it, couldn't we?
Yeah,
of course we could win it.
The possibility. The fact possibility exists. Yeah,
exactly. And then you've also got to stop and think, you know, you do remember last year playing against, you know, the likes of Millwall and Barnsley and whatever it is that, I think that game down here against Barnsley was just, we had a half a game that was just the worst yeah. game in the world. I have no idea what happened. And now we're talking about playing against Spurs and the win against Man City. So, hey, you know, bask in the glory of what we've got now.
Final thing before we wrap it up then, Tony, looking ahead to the summer, what do you think Leeds need to do besides the left back that we've spoken about?
Yeah, I think it is a big summer. And that's why these games towards the end of the season are important, because, you know, the outside world is looking in. Unfortunately, we have got great exposure, haven't we, this year? You know, we are the entertainers. Marcelo Bielsa is, you know, now this mastermind. So I am sure there are a lot of players now that would like to come to the Premier League, you know, would be looking. If you haven't got Champions League, you've got to be looking, well, where's a nice fit for me? I wouldn't be surprised that they're looking at a club like us. Absolutely, you know, why not? They want to improve, and under Marcelo Bielsa, you know, that would certainly happen. So now it's making sure that Victor Orta and the boys get the recruitment right. And if you think of what we brought in the last transfer windows, I think we've got a Brazilian international to come. I think Rafinha will get in capped. Of course, we have a German international, a couple of Spanish internationals as well. That's the sort of level we are now operating at. So it's going to be exciting. But of course, with that becomes a bigger outlay and more risk. So the boys have got to kind of get it right. So we'll spend a bit of money of that, there's no doubt. Hopefully we spend it wisely. And rather than buy seven or eight players, you know, I'd like to see three or four good quality players come in to really strengthen. And where we said, you know, probably left back, obviously midfield, maybe someone alongside Melia as well. I know Marcelo always loves a wide man, so maybe one of those as well. But yeah, I think we all know where the kind of positions are, but it's just getting the right fit for the right money to make sure that we keep on solid ground and keep going up.
Well, history shows us that we sign a left back, quite expensive left back, after the first season back, and then we go on and win the league the season after. So,
well, I was delighted. I didn't. Yeah, I was the record signing, wasn't I, at the time?
For a little while.
For a day or two, wasn't it? I mean, that's about it. But yeah, unusual for a left back to do that. But yeah, I think in the modern game, certainly, fullbacks are even more and more important. The way we play, I think absolutely are. And if we can get a good one, then on we go. But yeah, I think the boys, we just got to look at what they've done so far this season, and they have been wonderful. They deserve all the plaudits they get. They deserve their chance to shine in the Premier League. But now, as a club, we want to take that little step up.
Pleasure, Tony. Thank you so much for coming on.
Cheers. Thank you.
You can get in touch with The Phil Hayes Show via Twitter, at The Phil Hayes Show. Subscribe to The Athletic for that $3.99 a month for 6 months, 40% off the full price of a subscription. You can find that with ad-free versions of all our podcasts included as well, theathletic.com/LeedsPod. Next week, joined by Leeds United's Chief Executive Officer, Angus Kinnear. We'll speak to you then.
The Phil Hayes Show.